Welcome to Season 2 of Inflammation Nation. My name is Peter Boyd. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. So joining me today on this edition of Inflammation Nation is consultant rheumatologist in the Mater Hospital and professor of medicine in University College Dublin, Geraldine McCarthy. Geraldine, you're very welcome to the show.
And thank you so much for having me, Peter.
It's great to have you here. And we're going to talk about something that's really important and a very interesting topic, something that you've been involved with for many, many years, I know, which is gout and crystal formations. Can you tell us a little bit about the background and your involvement with this form of arthritis?
I always found it interesting, even as a junior medical doctor, but I only really got stuck in when I went to the United States to train as a rheumatologist in a center for excellence for crystal deposition diseases, including gout. And it was while I was there, I realized what a specific diagnosis it is when you can make the diagnosis and how specific the treatments are. And so over the years, having done some research into it and recognizing its importance and how poorly it is managed over the years and in different countries, I have maintained my interest because I firmly believe with enough attention and enough education, it is a disease that can be technically wiped out, but it is not happening. And I'm really interested in why that is. And I think having conversations like you and I are having now, hopefully will attract some listeners. And the more we can educate, the more likely it is that we can get on top of this disease that is a curse for those who have it.
And it's interesting, there's so many things that you've just raised there when you talk about it's something being a curse and very difficult to manage and things like that, but also the hope that's there that you can really get on top of it and almost do away with it if you get the right treatments and things like that. It's something that we encounter in all the different forms of arthritis, looking for the cure, so to speak. Is that something that we can say with confidence with gout?
We can say that we have the tools to do it. So with the other forms of arthritis, like, say, rheumatoid arthritis, where you've got daily persistent symptoms, you're reminded to take your medication because very quickly, if you don't take your medication, all that joint stiffness and pain will recur. With gout, particularly in early years, it is manifest by sporadic, very severe attacks or gout flares, which, if the gout isn't managed, will become more frequent and involve more joints. However, if something happens you just every now and again, it's kind of easy to forget to take your medication. So I think that's part of the problem. It's a little bit like high blood pressure. I mean, I'm not sure what the compliance for high blood pressure medication is, but it may not be that great because the consequence of high blood pressure, if you don't treat it, is heart attacks and strokes. But they're things that just happen, but not in between times, if you know what I mean. So I think that's one of the challenges with gout. And so the person needs to be reminded by themselves of how severe that attack was and how they don't want it to happen again and how taking this medication will prevent that happening.
And that's what we're looking to do. Well, if we go back to the very beginning then and look at those sporadic attacks as you described them, what exactly is happening within the joint or within the body when a gout attack is happening?
So how gout develops in the first instance is that the individual with gout will have too much uric acid in their system over time. And most people have too much uric acid in their system because their kidneys don't excrete it. And why that happens is hugely genetically based, actually, although it is exacerbated by lifestyle issues as well and high blood pressure and so forth. In any case, with the passage of time in predisposed individuals, and we don't know why it is that some people who have high uric acid deposit gout crystals in their joints and why others don't. And in fact, there's an international collaboration going on to look at the genetics of why that might be. In any case, some unfortunate people develop these crystals in their joints that once they're there, they stay there. And every now and again, if there's an imbalance in their system of uric acid going up or down, it destabilizes the crystals in the joints and they declare themselves and the body fights against them. And what the patient experiences is fairly acute onset, typically at nighttime, acute severe pain, redness and heat overlying the joint. And it's so severe that they can't bear the weight of a sheet on it. This attack in the initial stages will settle by itself within a few days, even without treatment. So that's what it looks like. But it can happen. I mean, the big toe is the typical joint involved, but it can happen at the knees, the hands, the elbows, pretty much everywhere with time.
And we're looking at the different joints there. And as you say, it can go away after a couple of days and maybe there'll be a gap before it happens again. Would that mean that there's a lot of people that maybe are living with this and not sure exactly of what's happening and maybe going undiagnosed?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And in between those flares, those crystals are still in the joint. And we know that those crystals are living in the joint mixed in with inflammatory type cells. So in fact, it is a chronic inflammatory state. And therein, I believe, lies the reason why there's excess mortality and morbidity from a cardiovascular point of view with gout, because it's a chronic inflammatory state, even between attacks.
And I think that's something that we really need to look at when we're talking about gout. There's almost a stigma or jocular nature almost to describing people who are living with gout. But that's a very, very serious outcome that you've just described there, and something that people need to be aware of.
It is. It's very serious. We know that with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, there has been a cardiovascular mortality associated with it, particularly in the past when we didn't have good treatments. But epidemiologic studies have shown that with the passage of time and the great treatments we have for rheumatoid arthritis now, the mortality associated with it, while it's still not normal, has diminished substantially. Whereas in terms of gout, the mortality associated with it hasn't changed one whit over time. And that's something that people don't realize. It's because having those deposits in your body is not a good thing and can lead to heart attacks and strokes. And people don't think about that.
No, it's something that I'm sure lots of people are unaware of and unaware of the links. And if you have those attacks coming on and they're sporadic and maybe coming a little bit more regular, what should you do or how do you go about getting the treatment for it?
So the first thing is to get a proper diagnosis. And it's a difficult one. I was at a lecture recently where a key opinion leader said it's something that needs to be managed by primary care. And I'm not sure that that's actually going to work. And I asked him why primary care. And he said, because there's so many of them. If you had rheumatologists look after them, the system would be overwhelmed. Personally, I attract people with crystal-induced arthropathies to my clinic because I feel, I mean, it's something I'm interested in and I feel I do quite a good job in managing them. And in fact, they get managed well, diagnosed well, treated well, and then the GP can look after them thereafter. So as it stands, the best people to look after it, I think, or rheumatologists, and in particular rheumatologists who can confirm the diagnosis by using polarized light microscopy. Now, that's not available to everybody, but there's a lot of interest now in ultrasound, and a lot of rheumatologists are able to diagnose gout almost 100% using ultrasound. But again, it depends on how well trained you are. So that's very encouraging.
And as a patient and someone maybe who's not altogether familiar with some of the terminology there, you described something polarized light microscopy.
Yeah.
So is that another test that's done? Is it invasive? Is it, or what way would that? What would that be involve?
Okay, it's a special sort of microscopy, and I think everybody knows what a microscope is, but it has a special characteristics that if you look at a gout crystal in joint fluid, using this microscope, you can confirm with 100% certainty that it is, in fact, gout. And so what we do is we'll take a sample. It can be a really tiny sample from an inflamed joint. And we put the sample on a slide and put it under the microscope. And by using the technology in the microscope, you can say this is definitely gout. And there can be people who've been troubled for years and they end up in our clinic and we can say, you have gout. And they're like, oh, thank you so much. I really wanted to know what was going on. And then you start them on treatment. And literally, that might be the last time they ever get an attack.
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
It's wonderful. It's really encouraging. But it's tough on the people who don't get the diagnosis in the first place.
Yeah, and it's important to get that. And you get to a place with a diagnosis, and you mentioned the treatments and things like that. How is gout treated? How do we go about looking after those attacks and reducing the impact of them?
Well, first of all, you treat the acute attack, and there are a number of ways you can do that. For people who aren't risky, you can use an anti-inflammatory. What I mean by risky is that people who are taking anticoagulants, for example, aren't ideal, or people who have a bad history of cardiovascular disease aren't ideal, or people who have history of peptic ulcer disease. But lots of people can take these drugs, particularly the younger people. I'm a big fan of colchicine, which is a more specific drug for crystals. And I'll talk about that more in a bit. We can use intra-articular steroids, or even if somebody has multiple joints involved, we can give them oral steroids or intramuscular steroids. So that's the acute attack. But in terms of actually getting to the root of it, you need drug therapy to lower the uric acid, and you have to lower it enough. So, for example, there's a drug called allopurinol that is used for gout, and or Xyloric would be the typical trade name. And people typically are given 300 milligrams, and there are people who need 800 milligrams. So it's a bit like diabetes. You wouldn't give diabetic patients all the same dose of insulin, but it's the same thing with gout. And that's something that people really don't realize. So you have to treat to target. And there are specific targets that have been established. So for people who don't have what we call tophi, or clumps of gout crystals sitting in their joints, the target is 360 micromoles per liter. And for those that have the more severe version, it's 300 micromoles per liter. And that's what you've got to do with the medication. When you start patients on these drugs, they're at risk of enhanced flares, paradoxically, because when you start these drugs, you destabilize the uric acid level in the blood versus the joint. And so that gives you a paradoxical increase in attacks. And if you don't give them something, what we call prophylaxis, to stop that happening when you start the treatment, they are going to stop their treatment. So it's really important that when you start urate-lowering therapy, you also give prophylaxis. So I typically prescribe colchicine, 0.5 milligrams twice a day. And while the guidelines will say for 3 months, in practice, it can be for a year or even longer. And it's very effective.
And it's very effective. And it's all about education as well there. And you're talking to your patient, you're giving that discussion, explaining what's going on within the body. And is that one of the key issues, is raising that awareness, doing podcasts such as this, is talking to people, explaining exactly what's happening within the joints, so that there's a greater understanding of what exactly gout is?
Yes, it is really important to educate. We have a booklet actually that came through Arthritis Ireland that we give all our patients. Having spoken to them, then we reinforce it with the booklet. I'm very lucky because I have a camera attached to my microscope. So when I take a sample from a patient, I put it on the slide, I can actually show them their crystals. And a picture paints 1,000 words. Yeah. So they can really, because they look evil, they're needle shaped. So when they see those, they're like, oh my goodness, I'm going to take my medication.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating insight, because we often don't see, you know, with forms of arthritis that are invisible, and we don't often see what's going on and what's causing our pain and different things like that, to be able to really have that evidence painted in front of us, as you say, paint 1,000 words.
Yes.
And we've looked at very, very detail about the specifics of it, the diagnosis, the treatment, and the different things like that. Unfortunately, with gout over the years, it's developed, as I mentioned earlier, that kind of humorous outlook and almost a stigma. Is there a reason for that, or can you pinpoint where that's come from?
I think it's at least in part historic. So it was known in the past as the disease of kings. And you'll see many old pictures of a very large king person lying there with the foot up on a stool and a very grim face. And part of that history came from the fact that there was an awful lot of port drinking back in the day, and that port was kept in lead-lined containers, and lead can cause lead poisoning, and that can cause kidney damage, which reduces the excretion of uric acid. So it was associated with rich living, kings, eating too much, drinking too much. And for some reason, that has persisted. And so, and also because it tends to happen in men more than women, particularly premenopausally, and since drinking alcohol can precipitate an attack in individuals, I guess it's kind of the boy culture a little bit, but it is, it's not good. I mean, my patients have, and typically men, and have said it to me in my consulting room, you know, I was really embarrassed to say anything about this. And there are a number of really lean, fit men that have come to me with their gout, and they're like, this just doesn't fit my stereotype at all, you know? Yeah. So that's where the genes come in.
Yeah, and there is a genetic component to gout. And, and is it something that is guaranteed to be passed down, or is there triggers, or what's the link there?
Well, the genetic predisposition it's not necessarily guaranteed, because obviously a parent gives a different version of their genes to the offspring. But you'll often hear a patient say that their father or their grandfather had it. So there is that genetic predisposition. And the predisposition typically amounts to the kidney not excreting the uric acid as much in the affected individual as the other person. But that doesn't mean to say that people can't help themselves. So with the obesity epidemic, we know that diet alone won't help gout, because there is a school of thought that if you just eat the right foods and get rid of urate in your diet, you'll be grand. That is not true. But I think for your general health, healthy living, not drinking too much alcohol, avoiding obesity, keeping fit, eating the right foods, all of that is going to help too, but it's not enough.
Okay. And you mentioned there about eating healthy, but also keeping fit. Is there any impact for people who, say, are walking or running or anything like that, with the fact that the big toe and those parts of the body are impacted mostly? Would that have any impact on their ability to keep fit or to take part in activities like that?
Not in between attacks. In somebody who hasn't just yet been diagnosed or treated, they might find their first attack comes on having run a marathon, for example, because in that case, they get severely dehydrated potentially, and that could bring on their first attack. But once they're caught early and treated properly, the exercise won't be a problem. But the classic story you hear is the chap who's worked very hard, and now his family have gone, they've all gone to Mallorca for a holiday, and now he's having drinks every night, and the whole holiday's ruined because he got his attack, you know?
Yeah.
So that classic.
And you mentioned that, and you mentioned it's a male going on holiday, and that would there be a that big divide in the clinic? Would you see that as a male disease mostly?
Oh, yeah. No, it's hugely male, apart from postmenopausally. And the typical male, I hate being sort of stereotypic, but they tend to be very stoic and putting up with it. They're far from neurotic. And while that's delightful for me in the room, it's not delightful for them, because they need to be more neurotic about it.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah. You mentioned about the difficulty in keeping up with a treatment, you know, if you're having maybe the lack of an acute flare, or there's a gap between them. Is this something that would really lead to those difficulties you mentioned with heart and stroke and cardiovascular disease? Is that something that can be a real danger?
Yeah. I couldn't tell looking at one individual whether they'd be particularly at risk. But what leads to anybody having cardiovascular disease or a stroke is a mixture of things. It's again hugely genetic. You can't change your genes, or they might have high cholesterol or high blood pressure. But having gout will contribute to that whole group of predisposing factors. So it won't be the only thing, but it is a modifiable risk that can be dealt with if people appreciate it. So it's a small risk, relatively, but it's a huge consequence if you're the person who has that stroke or heart attack or dies. Yeah.
Another area I wanted to think about, this has been something that has been a life's work for you, really, of investigating crystals and gout and different things like that. Is it something that you're very proud of, that you've moved things along over those years?
Proud of? I don't think of it like that, but am I satisfied? Yeah, it's been really satisfying to spend all these years looking at, because there's three different types of crystals that I'm interested in. Obviously, the gout crystals causing gout. There's another one called CPPD, or calcium pyrophosphate dihydrate crystals, which causes a condition called pseudogout, amongst others. And there's a large international initiative now to try and improve that. And then I'm particularly interested in BCP crystals, which are teeny little calcium crystals that are very difficult to identify, and therefore they're not given as much as attention. But my research life has been spent looking at what they do in the lab. And we know that they're extremely common in osteoarthritis. And because they're biologically active, my overlying hypothesis is that they're a potential therapeutic target for osteoarthritis, for which we have no good cure. So, and again, it wouldn't treat all of osteoarthritis, but I think it could treat a substantial portion.
Wow, that would be a fantastic accomplishment and something to really look forward to. And I just wonder, you know, we see a lot of research being undertaken in Ireland now. We've chairs of rheumatology through Arthritis Ireland. Do you see yourself as an inspiration for the new researchers coming through?
Well, now you'd have to ask them.
You're far too modest to answer that, are you?
All I will say that when I do have trainees with me, I always like to be doing some research projects so that they can get, say, a project, a bit of education, and a publication at the end of their time working in our department. Because in terms of career progression, it's really important to have papers on your CV, but even more so, I hope I can perhaps inspire them to be interested in research forever. And that's quite challenging in Ireland at the moment. I mean, you will know, listening to the media, that the system is overwhelmed. So it really takes a lot of determination and a lot of work outside, extracurricular work, like weekends and nighttime, to keep it going. But it does make the day job very interesting.
And if I could just finish with the day job, and one final question: if our listeners take something away, one point about gout, what's the most important thing for them to remember if we're raising awareness and understanding among the population?
To take it very seriously, and if you think you have it, make sure to get looked after. And I am very happy to see people myself. And I've said that many times, and I've yet to be inundated. So,
well, there's the call out. Professor Geraldine McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us on Inflammation Nation.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you for having me.
That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher, or as they always say, wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.